G'day.
What did you say?
G'day.
Uh-huh.
Oh, you my God. Do you know what I heard the other day?
What?
So there's a font called Arvo.
Mm-hmm.
That's an Australian.
As in the floats that measure ocean heat.
No. As in, apparently it's Australian for afternoon.
Arvo with a V.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
What the hell?
Yeah, afternoon, Arvo.
How do you get from... What kind of crazy contraction gets you from afternoon to Arvo? V.
I don't know. That's how we are.
We know the surface temperature of the Earth is warming.
Human activities are changing the atmosphere.
Simple, clear messages, repeated often by a variety of trusted voices.
It is time to forget about the old way of talking about climate change.
The ice caps were going to melt. They were going to be gone by now. But now they're setting records, okay? They're at a record level.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Evidence Squared. I'm Peter Jacobs.
I'm John Cook.
And today we are going to be talking with Dave Roberts. Dave is a writer at Vox. He covers climate and energy and some politics, as you will no doubt hear a little bit later on in the episode. And we actually lost a little bit of the introduction, but...
he had a great joke about his beard, which didn't get recorded, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, the price we pay. But we talked to Dave about a piece that he wrote in response to a podcast done by the Niskanen Center, which kind of talked a little bit about public opinion on climate and some climate messaging.
That's a pretty bleak conversation.
It definitely starts out on the high note of nuclear apocalypse, and it ends with the high note of not even divine intervention can persuade people on climate change. So,
right. Well, let's have a listen.
People ask me for my background. I never have a good story because I basically don't have one. I learned everything I know on the job is the short answer.
So then you are now at Vox.
Right. About 3 years ago, Vox came calling. Three years ago. It's all blurs now. A couple of years ago, Vox came calling because what I had evolved into, the voice I had found, kind of the style I had found, turned out to be explanatory journalism, basically. So it fit well with what Vox was doing, and Vox was looking for good climate people. So worked out well. And that's where I am now.
Did you come in with other people? I think with Brad.
Brad was one of the originals.
And Brad who? Sorry?
Oh, sorry, Brad Plumer.
Wanted to make Dave say, because I don't know how to pronounce his last name. So that was just
Plumer.
A trick.
God.
Okay, I was going to say Plumber, but good. All right.
I hope it's Plumer. Now that I'm thinking about it, I wouldn't even swear to that, but I'm pretty sure it's Plumer. Anyway, though, like Ezra Klein started it. He came over from Wonk Blog, which was at the Washington Post, and brought a bunch of people with him and brought Brad with him and Dylan Matthews, a couple other people. So they were all originals. And Brad's now at the New York Times. And so now we have Umair Irfan, came over from E&E, has joined the climate team at Vox, which is cool.
And but that was energy and Environment News, the
right, the trade publication. He was a reporter for them for several years.
Right. Okay.
So we got a little team of two now, covering the most important problem in the world.
Right. Well, that's still better than a lot of places.
Yeah. Better than none, right? Which is the standard.
One thing I'm always hassling Peter about is all the time that he spends/wastes on Twitter. I was hoping you could tell him a cautionary tale about overdoing it on Twitter. And
this is my intervention.
I mean, if you can't just look out at the world and find your own cautionary tales about using Twitter, you're too far gone. I mean, I would direct your attention to the president of the United States potentially starting a war with North Korea using Twitter as a cautionary tale. But I don't know if this is what you're referring to, but a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, I was very burnout, working way too much, all the time, basically, and on Twitter all the time. And I took a year off of working and all social media.
I thought it was just social media, but you basically took like a sabbatical from everything.
It was a sabbatical. It was 1 year of doing nothing, basically.
But you have a family and children, so that's not really doing nothing, right?
I mean,
maybe it was. I don't know.
I'm imagining sort of John Stewart in a log cabin.
Right.
Is that what it was like?
No. I mean, it was like a, what do they call it? A staycation. It was more or less just me hanging around the house, walking my dog, reading novels. Oh my God, I read so many novels.
That sounds like such a luxury.
I would take hours just to sit in a nice comfy chair by the window and just look out the window at nothing and just contemplate how I had nothing to do. And there was no reason not to just sit there and look out the window. It was really, it was delightful.
I got to say, I kind of hate you right now. A little bit.
That's, I can accept that. I get it.
It's worth it. Worth the price. So you wrote that up though in Outside Magazine.
Yeah, I wrote an article about it for Outside Magazine, which now I like am sort of quasi embarrassed to tell people about because all the kind of contentment and calm that I found through that experience has long since vaporized.
But you're not overdoing it as much on Twitter. You're relatively contained, I feel like, now.
I have a decent balance now. I took a little time off completely from Twitter again. And now, it's a constant temptation, though. It's, it's funny. Like, I joined Twitter back in 2009, and I always knew it was kind of a stupid waste of time and basically bad and that no one should ever tweet. I always knew that. But I never, in my wildest imaginings in like 2010 or whatever, imagined that Twitter would not just like degrade the lives of like hyper politically aware people, but would like degrade the world in like a substantial way and might even lead to the end of the world. Like, I, as bad as I thought Twitter was, I never imagined that it could literally like end the world, but that might be our epitaph as a species. Trump started a nuclear war on Twitter and then goodbye. That was the end.
I was going to try to pivot and say something like it's not all bad, but my heart's really not in it. But we do use it, you know, to hear what people kind of have to say. For science, it's great. I get people tweet papers that I don't have the time anymore to kind of search journals like I used to. And so I end up reading things that I never would have seen otherwise. But and we also get to hear people's takes on stuff that maybe they weren't going to blog. Ross, I'm blanking on his last name, at The Atlantic, is an editor.
At The Atlantic.
He's the science editor. Anyway, Ed Yong is one of the science writers there.
Yeah, and he's great.
I guess, I don't know if this was tongue-in-cheek or if this is true, but he tweeted like three times about something in a science context and then tweeted again, and Ross pops up in his feed and is like, said something like, you know, when you tweet four times, that summons the editor to force him to write something up about it. I thought that was very interesting because there is the temptation to sort of just fire off some tweets and then do nothing about it. But
this is hilarious. It's funny you should bring this up. Still to this day, much more so like a year ago, but still to this day, like one of the things that holds me back from doing even more tweet strings than I do is that virtually every one of them leads to some sort of communication from some editor at Vox saying, "Hey there, you know, we pay you to think of thoughts and write them down. Twitter really doesn't. So maybe you could think your thoughts on our site."
What's the process of translating a tweet storm to a piece?
Well, I mean, this is my problem is like a great example is, I did that the other day. I did a story about how, you know, like what if a tweet stream, basically, like what if Mueller finds out that Trump is guilty And because of the right wing, the power of the right wing media bubble, we just are paralyzed and the right wing never actually finds out about it. And right wing politicians can't do anything about it. And so we're just stuck with a president who's guilty of federal crimes and collusion with a foreign power. And we know it and we just can't do anything about it, which is like easy to say on Twitter, right? It's like, you know, but then like, hey, say that on the site. Like for me anyway, my process is like, I have very little, I can write super short on Twitter, or I can write like painfully longer than anyone wants to read on the site. And for some reason I've lost my ability to do anything between those two. So like for me, the process of translating a tweet string into a post is basically torturous and takes many, many hours and is like bleeding myself to rid myself of a fever or something. It's it's a horrible process, which is why I'm doing the tweet strings in the first place, right? They're right. So easy.
Well, you had one recently, which brings us to the topic of this conversation on sort of the reaction to a line of argument. And I guess I'll let John sort of lay things out and we'll just go from there.
Okay.
Yeah. So I read this article of yours with great interest, Dave, because my field is communication, climate communication, and in my field, researchers are constantly talking about how do we talk about climate change to conservatives. And so I was interested in your article, one, because of your take on that, and two, because I learned a whole new word that I'd never encountered before, agonism. But we can get to that later. But first, I'd be interested in, firstly, your thoughts on all the hand-wringing that goes on in the communication community about how to talk about climate change with conservatives.
I could talk forever about this. I don't know how far to sort of step back. But I think really that the division between the right, the conservative right in America, and everyone else, right? It's usually framed as the right and the left, but honestly, the real division is between the right, which is in its sort of hermetically sealed info bubble, and everyone else. And everyone else includes liberals and leftists and the center left and, you know, the disengaged. So I always like to clarify that it's not really a left-right thing in the U.S. as much as it's a conservative movement and everybody and mainstream and everybody else. So,
well, and not to interrupt, but Larry Hamilton does polling, and he separates out what he characterizes as the Tea Party faction and like the liberals, independents, and non-Tea Party Republicans are all closer to each other.
Even other.
"Quote unquote rightists."
No, that's totally right. It's not even the whole right by any means. It's definitely not the whole Republican Party. It's a distinct, you know, like if anyone in America knows who you're talking about. You know what I mean? Like I don't know how big that faction is. Like different polls, different find different things, and it depends on what kind of questions you ask and the context and everything. But somewhere around, I think, 30% of Americans, basically. But my whole point is I really think that there's the people who get involved in politics and science or the sort of the politics of science from the left just have different personalities and values and mindsets than those people on the right. And I think what people on the left do is kind of project themselves onto the other side and end up talking to the other side the way they would want to be talked to, you know, which is just a normal human. I mean, that's just a normal human thing to do. But especially people from science, especially people who come from the world of science. This is sort of my theory about scientists. Is scientists learn early on the scientific method, right? Which is this. You know, you sort of start with as close as you can get to a blank mind, right? The Buddhist blank mind, and then you just let the evidence tell you what's happening, right? As much as possible, you let the evidence speak for itself and you only draw conclusions from what the evidence says. So you're working from evidence to conclusion, right? That's the scientific method. And that, and people, I think, in science and around science and even generally on the left sort of have taken that as their model of how human inquiry works. But in fact, that method of inquiry is profoundly unnatural. It is unhuman.
Referring to like the information deficit model, the idea that if we just communicate more information and explain
more than that, I'm trying to explain why that doesn't work. The reason that doesn't work is that people don't reason like that. They don't reason like scientists in their day-to-day life. In their day-to-day life, they reason like lawyers. They already have a case they want to make. They already have their political and cultural opinions and instincts and biases. And then they go and assess climate science based on those, not the other way around, right?
I think within the science communication and psychology field, like that's fairly well acknowledged and understood, is that the biggest driver of climate attitudes is either political affiliation or political beliefs.
Right. So what's the next step, though? What's the next step? I mean, I feel like the next step they take is, okay, well, let's reframe our language in terms of deep values and ideology. And so we're speaking to the real source of these beliefs, right? That seems to be the next step they take. But if you look at the literature on how people's opinions are formed, you will discover that it's not a matter of talk and persuasion. It's a matter of sort of osmosis and absorption from the communities and tribes that you belong to. So,
so just dressing up your argument in the right language is not, because it's not an argument to conclusion process. It's a conclusion backwards process. Just changing the way you make your arguments not going to make a difference.
Right. It's not, arguments are not words, free floating words that float free of human beings and contexts, right? Every argument is made in a context by someone in a particular social setting, right? And it's who it's by and what that setting is matters as much or more than the words. We just get obsessed with the words. So the way those people in that bubble form their opinions is by listening to the elite cues that come from the people who run that bubble, right? So, I mean, it just follows for me straightforwardly that the only way to get the conservative masses to change their opinion about this is for the elites on the right to send different cues. I just don't know any other answer. It's not ultimately going to matter at all what combinations of words earnest scientists and liberal politicians and academics make, because the people in question don't trust them. They don't trust any of those people. The people in question have got to get the information from people they trust. And furthermore, if the people they trust and listen to say those things, it doesn't matter whether their arguments are particularly genius or brilliant or clever or tap into the right values or whatever. They can make crappy arguments and the masses will follow along, because the masses don't really, in the end, care about the quality of arguments or even assess things on those terms. They just look to they don't have time to research climate. They don't have time to do independent, you know, whatever about it. They just are like, I'm a conservative. What do we conservatives think about this? That's what they get from TV and the news and whatever else. And if conservatives decided to think something else about it, and that was conveyed by Bill O'Reilly and Tucker Carlson and whatever, you know, Mike Huckabee, whoever on Fox News, all those people started talking a different way about climate change, even if their arguments were crappy. You know, it would work. Like, my point is, like, the words themselves, the quality of the arguments is a marginal contributor here. Most of what matters is the root through which people get this information. So, and this is what I concluded in my article today is, you know, to follow this chain of reasoning. This is what I was frustrated about, John. It's like, is the communication field reasons to that point and then stops or like takes a wrong turn, in my view. Like if you get to that point.
Well, I don't think that they've quite got to that point even. I think there's – because if you take a step back, when they look at what is driving conservative attitudes about climate change, they'll conclude that it's mostly political ideology rather than political affiliations and elite cues. So I think – at that point, that's where they veer off onto a different path and say, well, then we just have to communicate climate change in a way that doesn't threaten conservative
ideology. That's so frustrating to me because like all the there's entire books of social science written explicitly about this, namely most people don't have anything that even could be described as an ideology. I mean, just the word ideology itself implies a level of coherence and thoughtfulness that most people don't have. Like most people, insofar as they have ideological values, just have weird grab bag bits and scraps of things that might not even be internally consistent. And they just pick those things up from their tribe. So even the notion that people have these deep ideologies that are motivating more so than their social tribes is just crazy to me. Like most people don't think the way that scientists do. And most people don't think the way that political obsessives like you and me think, like in terms of issues and you know, ideologies and the structure of government. Like most people just don't know anything about any of that. So, you know, you get to the point that, okay, people are following elite cues. To me, the obvious next step is the only way to change that is to give them different elite cues. And the only way to change that is for conservatives to decide to stop sending those cues.
That's if your goal is to persuade that portion of the population. Right. But the alternative is you don't persuade them. You,
right, right. Well,
you
this
bypass
was,
them.
This was the ultimate
before
point of my
we,
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, Dave, but a few weeks ago I was at at Florida State University on a panel about climate communication with Jerry Taylor from the Niskanen Center,
which
is a conservative libertarian.
I know Jerry. I know Jerry pretty well. He's great.
Yeah, and so Jerry was basically making the same argument as you that elite cues was the main driver of conservative attitudes about climate change. And so his approach is to try to change the minds of elites by working with them directly, like talking to congressional staff and congressional members in direct conversations.
And and Godspeed to him, honestly. We've talked about this before. Like he is – like if anyone can change conservative elites, it's definitely going to be – someone from inside, right? I mean, Jerry Taylor was at the Cato Institute for years. He's got, you know, he's well established in that world. So they're going to listen to him in a way that they would never listen to you or me. But even him,
that's my question. Is there any hope of if conservative elites are the ones who are promoting all this misinformation that is misleading conservatives? Is there any hope that we can arrest that flow of misinformation?
Well, Jerry thinks so. but my worry is that he's still focused mostly on conservative politicians and conservative political players, right? The congressional you know, staffers and that level of people. But in my view, the sort of balance of power on the right has flipped, and conservative politicians now are not in control anymore of what's going on. It is right-wing media has taken over the party and is freaking out the base. And so the base is baying at its politicians, and a politician has no control anymore over what the base thinks or over what the base wants. And so even a politician who came around on this and who was convinced by Jerry Taylor's arguments more or less is consigning themselves to not getting reelected if right. they speak up about it, you know? So it's
this argument for, I would say almost a decade now. So like, let's say you flip James Inhofe. You flip him. You're Jerry Taylor. You convince him. The Senate's biggest climate denier. He says, okay, it's real. What's his primary look like? Like he's not getting past the primary season.
Right. Right.
So what good does it do to pick off an individual politician?
Exactly. My point, like the opinion making force, the motive force in the right now is the right wing media complex, who has incentives that are completely screwed up. Like there's no, if you're a right wing media figure, unlike a right wing politician, you have zero incentive to ever compromise or get anything done or encourage anything to get done. All your incentives point toward freaking your audience the fuck out at as much as you can all the time. That's how you make money. So there's no, I mean, trying to talk that elite, and that's the elite that I see really pulling the strings, talking that elite into sanity on climate is like 10,000 times harder even than talking to the political class, because they very directly and measurably make money to the extent that they freak their audience out. They have zero counterbalancing incentive to calm their audience down or to bring their audience around to a reasonable position on this. Why on earth would they ever want to do that? They get, you know, they get clicks, they get viewers when people are freaked out. If they started sounding reasonable and accommodating, you know, they would lose money. I mean, it's a one-to-one correspondence. So to me, it's if you find the true power center on the right these days, it's more in right-wing media than it is in right-wing politics. And the incentives for them are even worse than for right-wing politicians, all of which is just to say that in answer to John's question, I don't see much hope, honestly, in changing the current right-wing elite attitude on this, you know, which is sort of like where I got in my post. And if you talk to most leftists or most liberals, you know, God bless them. Like, you know, they're my people. I love them dearly, but most of them, you say there's persuasion won't work. It's a dead end. They'll just be, you know, they'll just gape at you. They're like, well, what else is there? That's all there is. That's what politics is. Like, what else can we do? Like the whole idea that there's an alternative to persuasion called fighting and winning is just alien to the sort of liberal mindset. I don't know why. This is obviously like a subject that left activists have been bitching and moaning about for decades. You know, I'm not far and away, not the first person to say it, but just sort of the institutional kind of, like, liberals want to be in a discussion. They really do. And to their credit, like, they want facts to matter, and they want, like, reality to matter, and they want arguments to matter. But they just, especially, I mean, you could not find a clearer example of the fact that they don't than the climate thing. Like, the arguments have been made. The evidence has been laid out. There is, I mean, we're getting to the point of reductio at this point. Like, there is no more clear way to lay out the evidence. Like, how clear can it be made at this point? Like, at this point, the people who don't understand are not susceptible to persuasion and evidence. So, you know, the conclusion I draw from this is the Democrats should get the courage of their convictions, realize that climate change and clean energy are winning issues. They're the right side of history, right? If you really believe that, and you're not just saying that, if you really believe that, then you should view our current moment as an opportunity. Because right now, climate and energy are not top level issues for almost anybody in the American public or almost anybody in American politics. They're still basically there for the taking. So if Democrats took them, instead of just begging Republicans to come along, please come along and agree with us on this. Please, it shouldn't be a partisan issue. This should be a bipartisan issue. Just give that up, claim it, own it, exclude Republicans, dominate it, and trust that over the next 10 years, these issues are only going to rise in salience and importance, because at the end of the day, reality still matters and the climate is in fact still warming, and and young people are in fact getting more and more engaged and concerned about this, and clean energy really is getting cheaper and cheaper and more cool and more ubiquitous. So these issues are winning issues in the long term. And if Democrats really had the courage of their convictions about that, they would see that there's an opportunity right now to grab those issues and own them and associate them with the left and take, you know, just take ownership of them, so that when people think of them, they automatically think of Democrats. The same way, as I say in my post, that Republicans did with national security back in the 70s and 80s during, you know, towards the end of the Cold War. They dominated that issue. They didn't ask Democrats, please agree with us about this. Can't we all come to an agreement about what we should do about Russia? No, they said we should fight Russia, and they dared Democrats to disagree. And they and if Democrats wavered even slightly, Republicans took every opportunity to call them weak, weak on national security, weak on defense, vacillating, won't protect your children. You know, they did not try to make it a bipartisan issue. They tried to own it and make the Democrats suffer for not being on the right side of it. What happened was is that they owned it. They were on the right side. They won. And so subsequently, the next 20 years of Democratic politics involved the Democrats trailing along behind Republicans saying, we're tough, too. We hate communists, too. We like war, too. We like the soldiers, too, begging to be let back into that circle. That's what, in my view, Democrats ought to be doing with climate and clean energy right now. Own it, exclude Republicans, and then believe me, Republicans will come back crawling, because these issues are not going to go away and they're not going to get less salient. So just, you know, like wage politics for once, rather than all this like whinging about getting everybody on the same page.
I mean, that's the common wisdom, isn't it? That political conflict is a bad thing. And
only on the left. Only on the left do right. They think that. Not on the right. They love it on the right.
It's kind of the conventional wisdom within political science. Like, you should avoid polarization at all costs.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, well, this is what Matt Grossman, I don't know if you've been following the kind of Twitter discussion about this, but this was basically Grossman's. He's the political scientist who did the podcast that I was writing about interviewing these people. His, you know, it basically point said that strategy, you know, in response to my strategy, namely the fight strategy, he said that will just increase polarization and further polarization. And you know what? I think in the short term, it probably will. What you'll get is an increasingly intense anti-climate right-wing minority that will over time shrink, and it will serve as an anchor on the Republican Party. It will serve as an embarrassment and a problem for the Republican Party. So fine, let's polarize it. Like, if you're on the winning side, why should you fear polarization? Why should you fear being associated with the winning side of an issue and your opponent being associated with the losing side? That seems like in politics the kind of thing you would view as a good thing.
So just briefly, I think you've kind of covered everything, like all the topics of your article. But the one thing you didn't mention was, and the concepts are laid out, but this idea of agonism, which I think is just firstly, it's a word I hadn't encountered until I read your article. Can you just just flesh that out a little.
Sure. Well, I can't claim any genius on that. It was just a tweet from someone else who tipped me off. A guy named Joseph Henderson, who's also a social scientist, tweeted it at me, and I looked it up, and I was like, "Oh my God, this is the word! Like, this is hey, this is it. This is what I've been looking for." You know, and basically, you know, it, in a nutshell, it's just the perspective or the view that political conflict is good. You know, obviously within limits. Right. You don't want armed conflict. You don't want conflict to spill out of the bounds of the law. But within that context, political conflict is good. It clarifies things. It educates people. When two passionate, engaged people arguing about something are more educational to watch than two people agreeing on some, you know, mushy poll tested line about it or slogans about it. You know what I mean? So, like, I think we're at a point with climate change where the public is just like, they've been like fighting about, they've been like back and forth about this forever, and it is or it isn't. And I just want this resolved, you know, like I just want this figured out. Like, let's just settle this. And I sort of feel like that's the kind of mood. That's what we need right now, is a reckoning. Let's fight it out. Let's fucking settle it. You know, like, and in politics, what that means is not talking them into believing you. It is amassing political power such that your issue and your coalition becomes a political force such that your opponents become afraid to be on the wrong side, right? That's not any sort of scientific argument is going to bring Republicans around. That is the only thing that will ever bring them around, is being scared of the electoral consequences of not coming around. That's it. So the only way for Democrats to move conservatives is to move conservative elites. And the only way to move conservative elites is to change their interests, change the incentive structure in which they are working such that they fear being climate denialists. And we have to create that context, create that circumstance. And that's a matter of politics and coalition building, not clever arguments and slogans.
Okay, so I would like to outline my position, and I'd be interested in your perspective, because we seem to be heading in similar directions from different disciplines. Like, my area is not politics, it's psychology and communication, but there's a lot of themes that you're hitting on that resonate with the approach I've been taking. When I talk about misinformation and climate denial, the most common question I get asked is, how do you change the mind of a denier? And the answer that I give is, you probably won't. And the solution to climate denial is not changing the mind of that small vocal minority. It's about inoculating the rest of the population against their misinformation so that they become irrelevant. And so I think that inoculation is one of the tools to making climate denial irrelevant. And by inoculation, I mean it's the same as vaccinating people against the virus. You give people immunity, or help them build up immunity, by exposing them to a weak form of the virus. So in the case of misinformation, by explaining the techniques of denial, explaining the ways that denial tricks and misleads people, it builds up immunity, and so that misinformation no longer influences people and makes it irrelevant.
Well, I should preface this by saying, God bless anyone who's working on this issue from any angle with any strategy, because no one knows anything. No one knows what's going to work. And the only way forward is to try as many things as possible from as many angles as possible and see what works, right? That's how I preface. That said, that still ultimately is acting on the presumption that politics works through information, right? And arguments and positions on issues. And I just ultimately don't think it works like that. I mean, I mean, this is going to be sound like a horribly cynical thing to say, but everything I've read on public opinion and how voters make choices, like everybody listening should read the book by Christopher Akins and Larry Bartels called Politics for Realists, I think is the, or no no Democracy for Realists, and it basically just looks at like folk theories of what voters are doing, you know, like they're assessing information, they're gathering information and drawing conclusions, they're putting together positions based on cues from this and that, just all these sort of theories about what voters might be doing. And it turns out that voters, I mean, might as well be throwing fucking darts at dartboards. There's no reason to be found anywhere in the process. It's a very disheartening book. If you have any scrap of faith in human beings' intellectual capacities, all of which is just to say that any strategy to me that is relying on or aiming for an educated public that reasons well is doomed to failure.
I think the public is not
going to be well educated about. They're not well educated about anything. Like, why would they be well educated about this?
But I think that's risking maybe a collapsing some distinctions that matter. And I think so. You're kind of making a case about politics, and that's, you know, that's one thing. And I think that there's political identity and sort of like who's in my tribe and who's not in my tribe. And of course that stuff really matters. But I think that also, you know, people have all of that stuff kind of goes back to people's conception of themselves. You know, like I have a sense mm-hmm. of myself, and I have a sense of myself within my tribe, and I have a sense of who's not in my tribe. But that's and maybe that's the biggest, most important thing on a day-to-day basis is this sort of my place in the tribe. But also there are other things that people have that are conceptions of themselves. And a big one in the United States still, despite, you know, all of the trends that would make you fear otherwise, is that people actually like and trust science, number one. And that remains true. That is true. To an extent that a lot of people do not believe when I talk to them about actually interacting with, you know, people who may be skeptical about this or that scientific theory, is that they are actually deeply interested and deeply respectful of science in general. So, mm-hmm. but then one more step even further back is that nobody likes to be a sucker. Nobody wants to think of themselves as being a sucker. And I think if you can leverage people's unwillingness to believe that they are a sucker, that is a different thing than trying to win them over through a rational, logical argument.
And that's what my research has found too, Dave, is that I found that when you showed how people can trick you about climate change misinformation, that that the misinformation was neutralized all the way across the political spectrum. So conservatives as well as liberals don't like to be played for a sucker. And when they learn the tricks used to trick them, they're not taken in by them anymore.
That's true, but let's also note that if you're a sort of average member of the conservative tribe these days, if you're in that bubble, you have now spent decades drifting in that direction, accepting one ludicrous thing after another. So at this point, for those people to accept that they've been played for suckers by their leaders, if they start pulling that string, you see what I'm saying? They risk everything, right? They risk their whole, like, there's no way, like, this has always been one of my reasons for skepticism, is the idea that you can sort of pluck climate out of this larger dynamics. Because climate is of a piece with a larger message that they're getting from their leaders. Like, it's all bound up in it. So if they pull that string and decide that their leaders have been bullshitting them about climate, all of a sudden they just keep pulling that string and they're going to have a dark night of the soul. You know what I mean? And so people are people don't want to do that. People are naturally averse to that. So they will try very hard to deny that they're suckers. Very hard. To the point that it's impossible to convince them, I think, on most, unless you can sort of like trap them in a room and like walk them through things for an hour or whatever. You know what I mean? But that's an unnatural way of communication. That's not how they absorb information in their day-to-day lives. There are always contrasting and competing messages barraging them. And there's always interested parties trying to convince them of the opposite, even as you're trying to convince them of one thing. So you just never like, I guess I believe that if you could like do a kind of psychological and intellectual therapy on these people one at a time, you could probably change them. But that's just as a scaled, you know, you just can't, that's not scalable.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm exploring is there ways to scale it up? And what we're kind of converging on is this idea of technology has amplified misinformation and exacerbated the problem, but we think that technology is also the solution, and using technology combined with the lessons from psychology to create applications, to create ways to get inoculating messages out there and respond to misinformation.
But it sounds like what you're doing, John, is trying not just – I mean, there's no way to do that purely targeted at climate. You ultimately are having –
No, it's not targeted at climate.
You're making people better reasoners, right? Better I don't know what you'd call it. Fact finders. You're making better, you know, better in truth seekers.
Yeah, critical thinkers. I mean,
if you want to describe, like, if there's one thing I can imagine that's even more difficult than like persuading Republican politicians to pass a cap and trade system, it is creating a nation full of critical thinkers.
Oh yeah, but the thing about inoculation is it works on several levels, and critical thinking is a powerful aspect to it. And I mean, if everyone was critical thinking, that would be, you know, a utopian world.
It would be a different world. Like, I mean, the thing is, people ultimately don't want, I mean, this is kind of what evolutionary theory tells us too, is like people aren't naturally desirous of truth. Like, truth doesn't do anything for us. We want acceptance. We want belonging. We want a sense of purpose. We want to love and be loved. Like, we have all these urges and desires, but the desire to know the objective truth about the universe is not a normal human thing.
But, I mean, not being taken advantage of is a very normal human feeling that is deeply rooted in people's day-to-day life.
And all the 50 years of research into inoculation have found that it's that fear of being misled, of being tricked, which is the biggest, I guess, factor or the most powerful force in inoculation. And that's not necessarily coming from that critical thinking, slower, deeper way of thinking. It's more an instant emotive reaction to the thought that people are tricking you.
But guys, if they really were averse to that, I mean, I really would like to believe that, but like, if they don't want to be tricked, look at the last 10 years of right-wing media. It doesn't take very much to figure out that you're being lied to by those people. There are open, demonstrable lies dozens of times a day. They're telling people that Sharia law has overtaken Illinois. And that's it's not that hard to go to Illinois and see that it isn't and realize you've been fooled. So why isn't that happening? If these people cared, they don't appear to care. That's what I'm saying.
Well, but I think we're again kind of falling into that trap of collapsing distinctions. So when you're saying they, I feel like we're kind of toggling back and forth between, you know, 50% of the country versus 30% or maybe even smaller, depending on which they. I think we can all agree that there probably is a they that's just that's going to be unreachable for practical purposes, you know, for a broad scale push for climate solutions within our lifetime because it's too many people, too self-reinforcing, whatever. But I don't believe that the average Republican voter, the average primary Republican voter, thinks that there's Sharia law is a Rush Limbaugh listener. I think we can go too far in assuming the characteristics of that subset stands in for the majority within that faction.
I concede all that, but now you're collapsing a distinction. Average Republican voter, maybe, is, or let's just say, call it half of Republican voters, all right, is a they, and the other half is, let's say, some form of non-they gettable. But the primary, the voters in the Republican primaries are precisely the ones that are the most likely to be in the Fox watching subset. And that's why they control Republican politics so far beyond their numbers, is they're the active ones. They're the ones who care and are engaged and come to town halls and vote in primaries. So it's not just that it's beyond their numbers. They are the ones who matter most directly to the electoral fortunes of Republicans. Like, if you want to get a primary challenger, if you're going to get a Tea Party primary challenger, it's precisely those Fox News watchers that are going to be the ones coming out to vote in that primary election. And they are, you know, pretty far gone. So it's like it's almost like the Republicans you can get are almost by definitions not the ones who are at the heart of the matter. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think that gets borderline tautological in a sense, but I understand what you're saying, and I think I kind of agree.
But I think broadly speaking, like, I'm pretty sympathetic to the argument you make in your article, and I think that the approach I'm suggesting is one tool that contributes to the goals that you're working towards.
Yeah, no, and like I say, and I wasn't just, you know, when I said my preface, I wasn't just kissing up either. Like, I really think a diversity of strategies is hugely important. But what I would like to see is, at the top, in the leadership of the left, a more straightforward, clear conviction. This is real. It involves a large-scale transition. It is the most important thing happening, and we really mean that. We're really serious about it, and we're really going to fight based on that. In my view, if there was a prominent political party that was actually acting as though it believed what it said about climate, that would strengthen all the other strategies as well. You know what I mean? Because people are more likely to believe something when the people saying it act like they believe it, right? And right now, Democrats have this weird thing where on the one hand, they're talking about the end of the world and a crisis and an immediate transformation necessary. And on the other hand, they just aren't acting like it. They aren't prioritizing the issue in any serious way. They aren't making any sacrifices to achieve anything on that issue. They aren't acting like the world is ending. So to me, just like having, and this is one of the sort of virtues of the Republican Party, is that it doesn't pussyfoot around about what it believes. It really says what it believes and defends it and won't back down at the first sign of disgruntlement or offense or whatever. You know what I mean? So like, if there was people, if the left took this seriously, all the other educational efforts and messaging efforts would be strengthened by proxy, I think, because I think there's a really deep fundamental, like, people, like I keep saying over and over again, people don't really come to their beliefs based on words and arguments. Like, it's more of an osmosis. And right now, if you're just absorbing from culture, you're not absorbing urgency about climate change. Like, it's in the words, right, sometimes from Democrats and lefties, but it's not in their actions. It's not in the culture. It's not infused in culture. And so people just hear the urgent words, and they sound a little bit hollow, I feel like, because there's no larger, deeper sense of urgency among even the people who are allegedly on the right side of this.
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree with a lot of what you're saying. I do think it's not, I think you're making an argument, and you have sort of a category of like where your discussion is centered. That is like, it's overlapping, but is not entirely kind of the same as the public understanding of science question, which is slightly different. And I do think that there is a little bit more room for change based on other kind of past examples. But it just purely in terms of the politics, I think that I'm pretty sympathetic with the idea that fearing polarization above all else is not politically, that does not make a lot of sense to me. I think, you know, like civil rights was a very politically fraught thing that, you know, there was, I think a political cost to, but people don't, well, I would hope a lot of people don't look back and regret it.
At the time, there were tons of people just like there are now.
Right.
And scolding Dems from the sidelines saying you're just going to stir up opposition. The exact same thing.
And like something like as relatively bipartisanly supported today as like Medicare was initially like a highly polarized topic that now has pretty broad bipartisan support, and people said, oh, you're alienating half the country, you know, don't push it. So on the politics side of it, I'm pretty sympathetic to the argument that fearing polarization is a little overblown.
Oh, also, and I would say on the science question, I mean, a lot of the reaction I've gotten to this post, and this is to a previous post about the right wing bubble, and this is a reaction I got a lot and expected to get a lot, which is, you know, you're just saying that conservatives are stupid and liberals are smart, right? And of course you're going to say that you're a liberal, blah blah blah. And I really, 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 I'm not saying that. What I think you can locate the difference is that people more or less absorb and hold to the norms of their tribes, right? Very frequently, these are not formal rules or of any kind. They're just sort of unwritten rules of your tribe. And I think insofar as the left has a better understanding of and appreciation of science, it's not because individual leftists are smarter than individual conservatives. It's that the left's norms suggest a certain level of deference to expertise, right? So it's just that if you're on the left, you're encouraged basically to accept the consensus science on you're encouraged to accept expert knowledge that comes from these institutions that we've evolved to find knowledge and to develop knowledge. So you can be a dumb lefty and just believe what all the other lefties believe and be more likely to come to true beliefs than you would be, even if you're a super smart conservative, just because the norms you apply are different. And the norms on the right are all about allegiance to tribe, and allegiance to truth necessarily transcends tribe. Allegiance to expertise necessarily prioritizes something above tribe, and on the hardcore right, they don't prioritize anything above tribe. So it's not individual capacities that are at issue here. You know, I always want to emphasize that.
Yeah, no, but I don't know that I completely buy that there's that much of an asymmetry in the sort of deference to science and expertise. I think I definitely understand why you're saying that, but I mean, you don't need to have the House Science Committee doing the things that it does in the language of science the way that it does, it doesn't need to make a case that, you know, like NOAA's tampering with the temperature record. It could just make the case like, hey, this is economic destruction and we blah, 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 blah. But they fight in the language of science. They're still picking the fight on the science side. And like, you know, the Creation Museum in Kentucky has stuff about DNA, like, and plate tectonics. Like, there's no reason, if that deference for science wasn't there, if science didn't carry weight with that demographic, those things wouldn't exist. Like, I mean, not to go too far afield, but I don't know how keyed in you are to like the reproductive health debates, but like on the conservative side, that is, it is dressed up in science to like a degree you would not believe.
Oh, no, I totally believe that. And the way I would describe that is, who was it that put it this way to me? It was Rick Perlstein. I don't know if you guys know the historian. Yeah. Rick Perlstein's great, really writes great history books. But he was trying to sort of articulate this. And he was like, the right, and again, I'm talking about the 30% here, whatever, you know, term we want to use for them. But the right sees that, appeals to transpartisan principles and standards work, right? They see that they carry weight, and so they use them as weapons. But that doesn't mean that they are committed to the transpartisan ideals. They're just committed to saying whatever works. And so they've sort of realized that in mainstream American society, if you phrase your arguments in the language of science, you're given a certain amount of deference and respect. And so they do. And it's the same pick an example. Like I mentioned this one in my post today too. There's sort of alleged devotion to free markets. Like, I'm sure when they're arguing against subsidies for solar power, they convince themselves temporarily that they are truly devoted to free markets. But of course, like when we're talking about subsidies for coal power, a whole different set of frames comes into play. It's not like that devotion to free markets has any independent reality. It's just a weapon they use to fight against policies they don't like. And it goes out the window when discussing policies they do like. And it's the same thing ultimately for science, I think. This is what I mean about try being above everything. It's just what works, right? What is effective? And they've noticed that appeals to principle are more effective than just, this is what we want and it's better for us, so fuck you. They noticed that that doesn't work very well. So there, you know, so
you think it's like a plausible deniability.
I don't even know how conscious it is. It's just like some raw recognition that this style of argument works. And so they'll use it as long as it works. That's why you have Scott Pruitt saying, I just want, you know, when he's talking about scrapping the endangerment finding and having some ludicrous red team exercise to determine the truth on climate change. That's why when he talks about it, he says, I just want an objective, transparent process so we can work through this. So like, I'm sure as he's saying it, he believes that that's probably what he wants. But does anyone discern any genuine devotion to open objective processes in Scott Pruitt's actions? No,
army of 30 plus bodyguards in a completely silent, secure briefing room is hiding something?
Well, he has recognized in some part of his reptile brain has recognized that appeals to transpartisan principles like objectivity and transparency, those seem to work. Like when he says those to journalists, they nod seriously and write them down. And so he says them a lot. But in no way is there any consistent devotion to those principles discernible in Scott Pruitt's personality. He just uses those principles as weapons. He does not respect them. He would not ever change something he does to his own disadvantage or to the disadvantage of fossil fuel companies based on principles. Hell no. You know, it's the interests of his tribe. It's the interests of fossil fuel companies that are always the first line item. He pursues those however he sees is effective. And in some cases, appealing to the language of principle and the language of science is effective. And so he does it then. But that doesn't mean he's really devoted to those principles. And I sort of see the same thing about the in the reproductive arguments. I see scientists making these sort of – the anti-choice crowd making these kind of quasi-scientific arguments all the time. I don't think any of them are genuinely committed to science. I mean, do you? They just make those arguments because they've recognized that, like, science-sounding arguments – get them places, get them quoted, get them in the newspaper, sound plausible, can't just be dismissed as partisan. And so they use it because it works. But do they really seem like they're devoted to scientific inquiry to you? Like, does it ever shape their behavior in any way? Does it ever show up in anything else they do or say? You know what I mean? It's just a tool for them.
Well, I mean, I am naive, but I do think that there is a little bit more. I don't know that I would go so far as to say that it would completely dictate their actions, but I think I would give science maybe a little bit higher place in their decision making if it wasn't bound up in the other questions than maybe. You would. I don't know that it's as purely utilitarian, I guess I would say, but
ask you this way. Say for if some miracle happened, God descended and said, I'm here to settle the question of whether, I don't know, abortion causes mental health problems later, you know, like, or whatever, to pick one of these quasi-scientific arguments. And God said, I am God, I am omniscient, and I can tell you, absolutely, certainly, that's bullshit. That's not true. Would a single abortion opponent change their mind based on that? Based on that science argument being refuted? One of them? Any of them? I mean...
this is not a question I was anticipating for this particular podcast.
They're using the science, but it's not like if the science turns out to be false, they won't just use something else, because it's not science ultimately that's driving it. They're abortion opponents, and they're looking for arguments to use to support that. And if one argument gets taken out, they'll just pick another one. It's the conclusion they care about, not the arguments. That's kind of my point. I admit that isn't highly cynical, and I in no way encourage anyone else, either you or your listeners, to adopt this toxic level of cynicism.
John, do you think that there could be some experiments about public opinion on abortion where that's used as an intervention?
A godlike intervention?
An experimental condition?
A god intervention. A divine intervention.
I mean, this is probably off topic, but there's one of the most hilarious psychology experiments I'm aware of was they took... This is in the 50s, back probably when the rules on ethics were probably a lot looser, but they took a group of teenage Christians and they presented evidence that proved that Jesus didn't rise from the dead. So, you know, they came up with this fake evidence and to disprove Christian faith.
Right.
And the result was the Christians strengthened their faith.
Well... You're making my point for me, and this is what I mean about the disparity between the two sides. I agree, Peter, that I'm describing it in sort of hyper terms, and maybe it's not so clean and not so obvious, but there is a real disparity, and here's a good way to phrase it. If God came down and said the arguments of climate change advocates are true, climate is changing. Human beings are responsible for it. I don't think anybody on the right would change their position. I honestly don't.
I don't know about that, Dave. Because
that's horribly cynical. But if God
wouldn't
came
that
down,
be the ultimate elite cue?
maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that gets to a really good
whereas
point.
if God came down and said, these arguments are false. It's all hype. It's all bullshit. It's not really happening. Is there anybody on the left who would hang on to their belief in climate change in the face of that evidence? No, because they're not you know, because they came via the evidence. And if the evidence goes away, the conclusion goes away. I just don't think most people in the 30% on the right are coming to their conclusions that way. They have their conclusion and they work backwards to the arguments.
Is there anything else in terms of either the Niskanen podcast or the article that we did not cover?
No, the only thing I'd emphasize about the podcast is that even if you don't share my degree of cynicism about the sort of impenetrability of the right on this issue, I really think the kind of research, the second kind that Grossman highlighted in that, which is tweaking the language you use on surveys until you get better responses from conservatives. I just wish that people would quit paying so much attention to that kind of research. I just don't think it tells us anything about how messages and politics and people work in the real world. And all it does is get out the climate side all fired up for some new messaging, you know, initiative. Now we're all going to talk about children's health, you know, and just like thousands of man hours go into the PowerPoints and the meetings, and then everybody starts talking about children's health. And of course it doesn't work because it never had anything to do with that in the first place. Right. So just like I just that kind of research is like a shiny bauble for our side, and I wish that we could learn to ignore it.
Yeah. And I will say this, I don't think that is purely a bauble for sort of the communications folks in terms of the researchers. I think part of the reason why that has become that, I think that appeals very deeply to media people because it is their job to explain things and to write about things.
Yeah.
And if everything,
well, everybody on the left loves words, right? Scientists love words, journalists love words. We all wish that words were the currency of the world. Right. We all deeply wish that. Believe me, no one more than me.
Yeah. How fantastic would it be if it was just a narrative away for people whose job it is to do narratives for a living?
Exactly. And honestly, like relative to politics, which is like getting up out of your chair, making phone calls, going to meetings, being frustrated half the time, accepting half a loaf most of the time, failing most of the time, just the sort of grinding work of politics. It's easy to sit in your chair and think of messages. Like anybody can do it. That's why, you know, that's why it's the favorite indoor sport on the fucking climate left is sitting in your chair and thinking of messages. It's like no expertise required, no real work required. If this could solve the problem, hell, I can do this.
Well, I think that about covers it, and we will, see how this all shakes out with John's arduous and rigorous experimental research into human psychology on the one hand, and Dave's deep nihilistic bleak view of humanity on the other. We shall fall somewhere in between.
I'd like to formally apologize to all your listeners for depressing them and stealing their hope. That is kind of my it's kind of what I do.
Who would have thought the conversation started with nuclear apocalypse and then it went down from there?
Right. All right. Well, Dave, thank you so much. And we will post links to the original podcast and your response to it, and maybe some other pieces of social science research that are relevant in our show notes.
Awesome.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dave.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
All right.
Have a good weekend.
See ya. So that was a lengthy discussion. I think they covered a lot of ground. I definitely agreed with some of the stuff, maybe most of the stuff that he was saying, but I'm not quite sure all of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not quite so nihilistic. I think that if misinformation works, if elite cues messaging works, then messaging works. So I think that there are avenues in there. We just have to work at it and find those avenues.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think that anybody is in a single tribe. And I know that in climate discussions, we sort of we view things as ideological and, you know, partisan stuff is so primary that I think it's easy to remember that, or it's easy to forget that just because something is maybe the most important thing, that doesn't mean it's the only thing that matters. And that I know just from personal experience that there are people who may have a particular worldview, but their self-conception involves them, you know, kind of being on the right side of science. And that is actually something that matters and can change their views on scientific issues.
I mean, that's what my whole body of research is based on, that principle, in terms of misinformation and inoculation. But I think one of the most powerful points that Dave made to me was just pointing out that conservative media has a strong incentive to keep generating misinformation about climate change. And if that continues to happen, then a lot of these, proposed interventions that climate communicators are exploring aren't going to make much headway.
And why do, and so I think maybe I mentioned briefly the McWright et al. 2016 paper in the discussion, but what does that, more specifically, what are you talking about?
The idea that media outlets like Fox News and conservative newspapers, but I guess Fox News is the huge elephant in the room, that they continue to generate misinformation. And that means that if we try to come up with ways to reach conservatives without addressing the continual production of misinformation, misinformation cancels out positive information. So all our efforts are in vain.
Right. So if you have a message that somehow bypasses these ideological filters in sort of an experimental setting, whether it's appealing to worldview or appealing to something like public health, you have these sort of framing tactics. We have seen research that shows that if you pair those frames that work with counter messaging, all of a sudden they stop working, obviously. And in the real world, as you were just mentioning, as Dave was talking about, there's kind of constant counter messaging.
Yeah. I think that, Dave alluded to this, I guess, liberal aversion to conflict. And I see it all the time when I talk about misinformation and denial. It's really an unwillingness to even acknowledge that all this misinformation and denial exists, or just wanting to get on with it without having to address that issue. Can't we just talk about the science? And the fact that misinformation cancels out accurate information means that we can't afford to ignore denial and misinformation, and it has to be dealt with.
Do you think that there is a conflict? If you are listening to the podcast and you hear Dave's argument about sort of, you know, just going for political victory, if you're a, you know, a liberal or a democratic, you know, sort of voter, and he's making sort of the political argument of win this fight, is that as inconsistent as it might seem with the idea that we can kind of keep, from a communication standpoint, studying messaging? Is that inconsistent with inoculation theory?
Oh, not at all. To me, I think inoculation is, as I said, one tool that can be deployed to, like Dave mentioned, this idea of essentially putting a price on denial, making people who misinform the public have to have a political price for it. And there is research that shows that when you make elites aware of the price that they may pay for misinforming people, then they become more accurate. I think that inoculation is a way to be used in not only just for messaging and communication and education, but also as part of that political mix as well.
What do you think about this idea that, you know, sort of the navel gazing aspect of the messaging standpoint, that, you know, kind of there's sort of a self-involved aspect of, if we just kind of sit around and keep thinking up these these different ways to get through, then that's all we need to do. Do you feel like that was a fair criticism?
Yeah, I think so. I think, and I'm guilty of this as well. Like,
I mean, I feel like I'm guilty of it. I think a lot of people who are interested in it, in the subject of Canadian climate, are guilty of it.
I mean, it's a holistic problem. Like, there's social factors, there's political factors, there's technology, and there's individual cognition. A holistic solution is needed that kind of pulls all these different disciplines together. And that's really difficult. So for myself as a cognitive scientist, I'm mainly focused on individual cognition and how to come up with inoculation strategies that, you know, stop people from being misinformed. But I think that we need to start stepping outside of our lane and working with other disciplines. And I think that's hard. Like, I've just spent the last 6 months working with critical thinking philosophers on coming up with practical ways to inoculate against misinformation. And the first few months was just a cognitive scientist, used to quantitative research, running experiments, working with numbers, working with critical thinking philosophers who speak a completely different language. And it really took us a while of back and forth before we started to kind of understand each other. So interdisciplinary research is hard, but it's the key to coming up with solutions that bring together all the factors.
So it took you guys a while to get socially calibrated, to use yes. a term of art.
Yeah,
when you mentioned to Dave that you were kind of talking about how technology was sort of a source of spreading this information and that you hoped it would be a tool there, we could use it to kind of fight it. Can you maybe speak generally about what you meant without getting too specific?
Well, we just published the paper, myself with Stefan Lewandowski and Ulrich Ecker, on the idea of technocognition. And that's really what I just said. It's an interdisciplinary approach where you bring together psychologists and computer scientists and political scientists and just people working in different disciplines, because this issue is broader than just one single discipline, and come up with holistic solutions. And technocognition is a word that Stefan Lewandowski came up with.
I'm actually shocked to hear that he's the one who coined that term.
He actually came up with it after several beers into a conversation in a pub
John,
in Bristol.
Let me tell you.
and so he came up with that word, and I said to him, I basically dared him to use it in a slide in his presentation at the psychology conference the following day. And if he did, I'd buy him a free beer. And so he did it. I think he'll do anything for a free beer. And it led to us writing this paper.
So then he did you one better and put it in the paper.
Right, that's right, yeah. Well, I think he loved it so much that, you know, he invented the word. So, And so now the real main thrust of the paper is that technology has contributed, has amplified this idea, this problem of fake news and misinformation. And technology, therefore, has to be part of the solution. There are attempts to use technology to counter fake news already, like Facebook are providing fact-checking services, and Google are putting fact-check links in their search results. But there are cases where these attempts by Google and Facebook and other social media outlets are actually backfiring and having counterproductive efforts. And so we think that it's imperative not only that social media outlets are pushing back against Facebook, but they're doing it in an evidence-based way, drawing on the findings of psychology and other disciplines.
Great. I am looking forward to reading more about this kind of burgeoning interdisciplinary field. I will check out tell me again.
It's technocognition, and the paper's published. We'll provide a link in the show notes.
Awesome. All right. Well, I guess that'll do it for this episode. And how can people find us, John?
They can find us on Facebook at Evidence Squared or on Twitter at Evidence Squared.
And they can email me at peter@evidencesquared.com.
My email is john@evidencesquared.com.
And they can...
Most important of all?
Tell me. I'm blanking.
I was waiting for you to say it.
I don't even know.
find us
on
iTunes.
My brain is fried by the discussion that we had.
So find us on iTunes, Evidence Squared, and subscribe to us and rate us.
Yeah, and review
rate
us
well. Don't rate us badly.
Yes. Rate us with all of the enthusiasm and optimism that we did not have in this episode.
All right. Thanks very much. All right. Thanks very much.
All right.
See you
bye.
Later. Hang on. Let's do that last bit again because we both spoke over each other.
Which bit?
See you
bye.
Later. Oh, we did it again.